of Chapter 1, the 1877 Railroad Strike.
I'm teaching in the summer school right now at Pitt. I have 25 students in the summer class. It's a second half of American history, heavily oriented towards local history because so much, well, one, I'm a labor historian, and two, so much of America's industrial history happened in Pittsburgh. And I asked everyone, has anyone ever heard of 1877, when half the city, angry workers, burned half the city to the ground? No one.
The 1877 railroad strike was the biggest strike in the world in the 19th century. And the largest amount of fighting or loss of life was in Pittsburgh. So, I mean, this is an event that looms large, not just in terms of local history, but in many ways from a global historical point of view. And it seems to me, it's why I talk so much about it in the class, it raises the question about the nature of popular memory and how that may be flawed.
That was historians Eric Leif Davin and Richard Ostreicher talking about the same event on the historical marker across the street, the one you can't read. Actually, because of its location, it's almost impossible for anyone to read. Don't try to walk over to read it. There's a do not walk sign on the base, and for good reason. Seriously, it's dangerous. What is this official historical marker that no one can read dedicated to? To one of the most important events in Pittsburgh history, the 1877 Railroad Strike, also known as the 1877 Railroad Riot or the 1877 Great Labor Uprising. This is the only official marker to this event in the city. During this chapter, you'll relive the 1877 Railroad Strike through the lens of news reports written at the time, along with some additional thoughts from historians Ostreicher and Davin. Before you start, I want to point out a few locations of importance. The marker is located here for a reason. It is a spot where troops from the Philadelphia Militia formed a three-sided square and fired onto civilians. At the corner of 26th Street and Liberty Avenue was a large train roundhouse. These same soldiers would be trapped by an angry mob of civilians. Look all the way down Liberty Avenue. See the Union Station? It's a pinky peach building that, because of the curve of the road, will seem to be almost in the center of Liberty Avenue. This is the rebuilt Union Station, the original burnt down in the uprising of 1877. From the Union Station all the way up to 30th Street was a large rail yard. By the end of this chapter, this will all be in flames. The first part of Chapter 1 is going to be more of an audio stand than an audio walk. But a lot happened just across the street over 140 years ago. The railroad strike of 1877 started on July 14th in Martinsburg, West Virginia, in response to the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad cutting wages for workers for the third time in a year. By July 19th, it would spread to Pittsburgh, where freight trainmen, in an unorganized and unplanned action, decided to strike. Many historians believe it came down to the individual decision of just one worker, and exploded from there.
Thursday, July 19th, 1877, New York Times. At noon today, the freight train men on the Western Division of the Pennsylvania Railroad refused to go out with their trains. The strike is caused by the company's course in increasing the number of cars in the freight trains. The strikers and their friends, in all nearly 500 persons, assembled at the outer depot and by intimidation have prevented the crews from going out that have remained at work. At 3:30 p.m., 18 trains were in the railroad's company's yard, ready to go out, but without crews to run them. A party of strikers lost no time in getting out to the East Liberty stockyards and had a conference with the train and yardmen there, which resulted in the latter joining the strikers. Friday, July 20th, New York Times. The strike on the Pennsylvania Railroad continues. At 10 o'clock last night, Sheriff Fife, in compliance with a request from the railroad officials, visited the strikers at 28th Street and ordered them to disperse. This they refused to do. The sheriff remained there until 3 o'clock this morning, but his authority was defied. The strikers hourly increased in strength. There were today, at the lowest estimate, 900 loaded cars on the track between the Union Depot and East Liberty, and the maze of tracks promised soon to be occupied by cars heavily laden with goods for all parts east and west. Finding the strikers were not disposed to yield obedience to the civil authority, the railroad officers call upon the military.
Now look past the boring buildings towards the hill. Imagine the hill packed with people, spectators, men, women, children, and the local Pittsburgh militia. The governor of Pennsylvania was vacationing in Wyoming, leaving authority to Adjutant General James W. Latta. He ordered General A.J. Pearson to call out the regiment of the 6th Division located in Pittsburgh. Fearing that the majority of the militiamen would be sympathetic with the strikers, he telegraphed Latta, suggesting troops from Philadelphia be dispatched to Pittsburgh. So as the troops arrived from Philadelphia, the local militia, not called up, was standing on this hill looking down on the spectacle.
Friday, July 20th, New York Times. At 8 o'clock this evening, Major General R.M. Brinton, commanding the 1st Division, NGP, received the following dispatch. You will move your entire division, cavalry and artillery, via Pennsylvania Railroad to Pittsburgh, reporting on your arrival to Major General Pearson. Advise him and me of the hour of your departure from Philadelphia and your progress along the road. Ammunition will be furnished you at Harrisburg. The Pennsylvania Railroad will furnish transportation. James W. Latta, Adjutant General. Saturday, July 21st. Special dispatch to the New York Times. A terrible day in Pittsburgh. The strikers had thus far behaved well, their only overt acts being the stopping of freight trains from leaving the city. Today, things were destined to take a different turn. At noon, a detachment of troops numbering 1,000 arrived from Philadelphia, including a battery of artillery. Their men were placed under the command of General A.L. Pearson, and at about 3:30 o'clock, took up a line of march out of Liberty Street to 28th Street, where the first body of strikers was entrenched. Pittsburgh's Daily Post. The military were hemmed in on all sides by the strikers and their friends, so that their movements were made with great difficulty. Finally, three sides of a square were formed, their backs to 28th Street. During the scuffling that followed, the civilians grasped the bayonets of the military. Quote, "You sympathize with our cause, and you wouldn't shoot a working man," cried the daring fellows who thus toyed with the deadly instruments in the hands of the visitors. The local troops on the hillside all the while remained passive. The light blues of Philadelphia were here ordered to charge on the crowd. They performed a soldier's duty in obeying the order. Great confusion followed. Pressed by the mass of excited people, the militia fell back. Then some boys on the adjacent hill let a volley of stones into the ranks of the militia and the crowd of people. Special dispatch to the New York Times. The Philadelphia militia, it is said, without orders, fired two volleys into a crowd of women and children on the level, and into the Pittsburgh militia on the hillside. The result of the first volley was not a serious nature, but a second was ordered, resulting in 20 killed and the wounding of a large number. When news of the action of the Philadelphia troops reached the city, there was the greatest excitement among the working men. The arrival of the bodies of those slain added to this feeling, and it soon became evident that there would be serious and sad results. Some reports that shops where arms and ammunition had been sacked. Howling crowds paraded the streets. The feeble police force of the city was of no avail.
At this point, police start walking towards downtown. The troops from Philadelphia that fired upon the citizens of Pittsburgh retreated from their position at 28th Street to shelter at the Rail Yards Roundhouse. It would have been located at 26th and Liberty. We're also going to move in that direction. Please stay on this side of Liberty Avenue.
At this writing, I learn that the Philadelphia troops are corralled in the Pennsylvania Roundhouse, surrounded by a mob variously estimated from 10,000 to 30,000 men. Already three dead bodies of Philadelphia militiamen have been brought into the Union Depot Hotel. It is not too much to say that the sympathies of 9/10 of the people of the city are with the strikers, since it is a well-ascertained fact that they are not responsible for the bloodshed of this evening.
I would like you to look across the street towards the intersection of 26th Street and Liberty Avenue. At the entrance of the busway, in between the two nondescript beige buildings, I want you to imagine a large circular building made of brick. Inside, imagine the Philadelphia militia hiding from a large, howling mob of civilians outside. The citizens of Pittsburgh will eventually fire a cannon and set the building on fire. The militia will use a Gatling gun to fire their way out. Also, you will hear of rioters pouring gasoline over a load of Coke. On this instance, Coke is not referring to a soda, which wasn't invented until 1885. It is instead referring to gray, hard, porous fuel made by heating coal in the absence of air. It's an important industrial product used mainly in iron ore smelting, and it's highly combustible.
Sunday, July 22nd. Special dispatch to the New York Times. While a portion of the mob surrounded the roundhouse in which the military had taken refuge, large bodies proceeded to set fire to oil cars. The sight of flames seemed to craze the rioters, some of whom rushed wildly about with flaming torches in their hands, applying them to the cars indiscriminately. An alarm was sounded, and the fire department promptly responded, but the rioters, who had complete control of the city, refused to permit them to make any effort to extinguish the flames. They said they were determined to destroy the railroad company's property, but would do no injury to that belonging to private citizens, and they kept their word. When a lumber pile belonging to a citizen took fire, the rioters themselves turned in and helped extinguish the flames and remove the lumber to a safe place. A large party of strikers captured a car filled with coke. They then procured large quantities of petroleum, and pouring it over the coke, ignited the materials. In a very few minutes, the car was a mass of fire, and it was then pushed and forced against the roundhouse. Pittsburgh's Daily Post. About the time crowd began firing on the soldiers in the roundhouse, a number of civilians organized and marched up to 43rd Street, where they captured the armory at that point and secured several stands of arms. They then marched to a schoolhouse and forced the janitor to give the arms stored there. Special dispatch to the New York Times. At the roundhouse, the militia were hemmed in by an angry throng supplied with firearms and ammunition stolen last night. About daylight, the rioters succeeded in getting a cannon in position, and after firing one shot from the gun, the soldiers opened fire from the roundhouse and, covering the gun of the citizens with their musketry, prevented its further use. In the first volley from the soldiers, two men were killed. The wounded were numerous. At 7:30 a.m., the military again attempted to set out, this time coming out in good order and in solid columns. Their Gatling gun drawn at the head of the column as they went down 25th Street to Liberty and turned in the direction of the Allegheny Arsenal. The soldiers forced their way along, followed by the mob, and made their way amid a running fire to the Allegheny Arsenal, where they proposed taking shelter. The commandant, however, refused to admit them, and they were forced to continue their fight. They turned upon the mob and fired upon them with the Gatling gun, but the result of the discharge cannot be ascertained, although one of the crowd, who was present, told me he thought 20 persons killed. The troops kept on towards Sharpsburg, where they rested. Special dispatch to the New York Times. 300 freight cars, the shops, and roundhouse had been reduced to ashes, and $2 million of capital swept away. The transfer depot was burned next, and while it blazed, the freight cars within a quarter mile of the Union Depot were rifled. Men deliberately broke locks on the doors with iron bars, the boxes tossed out in a stack upon the ground, and then a flock of greedy cormorants pounced upon them. There were women as well as men in the crowd, blacks and whites. Now a box of calicoes would be scrambled for. Next, hams would be distributed. Then umbrellas, yarns, lemons, sewing machines, flour in barrels, lager beer in kegs, whiskey, boot and shoes, druggist materials, and even stationery. Anybody needing a new hat could get one. By 3 o'clock, all freight cars in the main yard had been burned or were on fire. Several of these run into the passenger sheds of the Union Depot. And in a very short time, that fine structure, including the Commodious Hotel, was a mass of flames. Monday, July 24th, The New York Times. No further disturbances of a serious character occurred at Pittsburgh.
On Monday, the main explosion of violence in Pittsburgh was over. In total, 39 buildings, 104 engines, and over 46 passenger cars and 1,200 freight cars were destroyed. And overall, almost 2 square miles of the city was burned. The state legislature's investigative committee estimated a total of $5 million in losses and damages to the city. That's $5 million in 1877 dollars. An estimated 53 civilians were killed and 109 injured. 8 soldiers were killed in clashes and another 15 were wounded. A total of 139 were arrested. According to arrest records, every working class from the unemployed to unskilled to skilled to management were all represented within the 139 arrested. The strike did continue. Late Wednesday, July 26th, at a federal cabinet meeting that included President Rutherford B. Hayes, it was decided state and federal troops would begin the following day to open the road to Pittsburgh. On July 28th, Pennsylvania Governor Hartranft arrived in Pittsburgh with fresh militiamen from Philadelphia, in addition to 14 artillery and 2 infantry companies of federal troops. 2 days later, the railroads in Pittsburgh would begin to resume operation.
President Rutherford B. Hayes, diary entry, March 26, 1886. Shall the railroads govern the country, or shall the people govern the railroads? Shall the interest of railroad kings be chiefly regarded, or shall the interest of the people be paramount?
At this point, regardless of where you are on Liberty Avenue, please turn and walk towards the intersection of Liberty Avenue and 26th Street. There's a good chance that you passed 26th Street and will now need to backtrack. As you do, take a look from the Union Station Hotel back to the 28th Street Bridge. Imagine all of this in flames. Imagine all of it in burned ruin.
And unlike master craftsmen of the past, cobblers or carpenters or someone like that who might start out as an apprentice cobbler and then become a master craftsman of his own someday and own his own shop and have apprentices in his turn, by the 1860s, 1870s, you're going to have people who are going to be wage workers for the rest of their lives. They're never going to own a little shop. And the nature of the economy itself is changing. In the beginning, even the first iron mills were so small that individuals could found them. By the 1880s, 1890s, even wealthy people can't do that. You can't start a steel mill. So you get the rise of something called corporations that existed long before this, but they become the dominant form of organization, which pool large amounts of money from investors to do this. Inevitably, the new form of the economy is going to create vast numbers of an underclass of wage workers and a very small number of people like Andrew Carnegie and Henry Clay Frick who are benefiting from the society. And 1877 was the first time that there was a mass insurrection, response, rebellion against these new economic developments precipitated by the Great Depression of 1873. Panic of 1873 was the biggest depression that we'd ever had in America up to that time. Vast numbers of people were thrown out of work. The misery was widespread. All they had was their anger, and they erupted in 2 weeks of rebellion. And although Pittsburgh was the center of it, it spread across the entire Northeast, all the way to San Francisco. St. Louis, Missouri, was taken over in a general strike, and it was run by a workers' commune until a wealthy middle-class militia commanded by 2 generals, one who had been a Confederate general and one who had been a Union general during the Civil War, led them to put down the general strike in St. Louis. This went on for 2 weeks. And so it awoke to America the fact class conflict is not something that's just relegated to Europe. Class conflict actually, shockingly, exists in America also. And there's this huge division in America that we didn't realize existed. Now, the central question in America became the labor question. And this was the beginning of 70 years, 75 years of labor conflict.
More than a strike, it's almost a kind of popular insurrection and depression of the 1870s. And I think it reveals to a lot of people 2 things. It reveals, first of all, how widespread discontent is. Often people who are financially distressed, who are unemployed, who are struggling, will blame themselves. If I had only worked a little bit harder or I'd been a little smarter, I wouldn't be in this boat. There's a lot of literature based on interviews that have been preserved for the unemployed in the early 1930s that was often the reaction of people who were unemployed after 1929. And then I think what gradually dawns on people is, hey, there's all these other people that are in the same boat that I am and are struggling with the same thing that I am struggling. There must be something else going on here besides my personal failings. And so an event like this, which, you know, is all across the country and involves hundreds of thousands of people, is a kind of revelation.
Mark Twain, Letter to Molly Fairbanks, August 6th, 1877. Pittsburgh and the riots neither surprised nor greatly disturbed me, for where the government is a sham, one must accept such things.
You
You should now be at the corner of 26th and Liberty Avenue. Turn north away from the hill and walk about a half a block towards Penn Avenue to a small alleyway called Spring Way. On the downtown side of the road, there will be a telephone pole with a sign that is oddly pointed away from the road. This sign is about the Great Strike of 1877, specifically the Battle of the Roundhouse. It was placed here by the Howling Mob Society, a collaboration of artists, activists, and historians. 10 years ago, the group covertly installed 10 signs documenting the historical event. 6 still remain. If you desire, pause the track to locate and read the sign. When ready, keep playing the current track. We will talk with two of the members of the Howling Mob Society, Sean Slifer and Mary Tremonti.
Yeah, yeah, the inadequacy of that marker and the misrepresentation of the event. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, noticing that around town too with other markers, you know, how people like Rick or Carnegie are represented on those historical markers in these very like politically neutral terms that favor people in power, you know, by not showing any other side aside from like kind of a top-down view of history. But being like kind of politically neutral, they are taking the side of people in power.
Yeah, so to ask, you don't think of them as actually politically neutral?
No. I think all of us involved in it, being kind of history nerds and like digging around and just finding out what a big event it was and having it underrepresented. And then for me and for some of the other people in our group, I can't speak for everyone, but like the tactic of making historical markers that look kind of like the legit ones or official ones. I don't know, like kind of mischief making, you know?
The spark, as I remember it, was the actual historical marker. Historical marker, the language on it always sort of bothered me. I think in trying to figure out how to talk about like a full-scale riot, it really became the story about what happens when, you know, a third of the population of a city or whatever hits the streets pissed off about a number of different things.
The railroad's invasiveness into everyday life. So many like children were killed by trains. There weren't safety railroad crossings like there are nowadays. Trains would just be coming like down the street, you know, next to traffic without warning. Yeah, and the labor conditions were really bad, but also just the presence of trains in non-train railroad workers' lives was really malevolent.
Now that we're near the end of Chapter 1, there are some obvious questions. First, why was the horribly placed historical marker back where we started the walk the only official acknowledgement in the city to this incredible event? It certainly brings into question what events get to be placed in the collective memory of the citizens of a city. Additionally, Kelly Carter Jackson, historian, argues that violent protest is a political language, a language for those who otherwise are unheard. The precision of the riot appears to illustrate this. The Howling Mob decided to burn down a specific 2 square miles of the city, the yard and the buildings belonging to the railroad. The people of Pittsburgh were saying something, and at a time of great wealth inequality, technological and economic change, this happened. It might be a good idea to have this front of mind now. To better put this into context, I decided to visit a lawyer, historian, and activist, Staunton Lind. That's Chapter 2. As we are physically moving away from the rail yard, the conversation will turn away from the specific events of July 1877 to try to put the event into a larger context. Over the next 16 minutes, walk to Smallman Street. At Smallman, take a right and turn east. Walk until just before the 31st Bridge. There, you will see a large, recently renovated metal building on the north side of the street. Stop there. Again, take a right at Smallman and walk until you almost go under the 31st Street Bridge. When you're ready, press the next track, start Chapter 2, and begin walking.